All right, this will be lesson 20 of church history. And again, I don't know how to tell you how many more there will be, but I've pared it down quite a bit from what it was, the 52 weeks that this was through the TBDI Bible study. I want to talk for a while about Islam here. Now, some of the stuff tonight is the routine stuff you would find, you know, online or whatever, I suppose, just, you know, not totally strange to everybody here, of course, but there is a little bit of a thing at the end of it that that may add a little bit of depth to this. But let me talk to you for a little while about Islam. Islam rose up in the 600s AD, and of course, from there it advanced. You can see on the right there the numbers, you know, starting in the mid-600s, you know, they started taking things over. And really, you know, they were defeated in Tours, France in 732. That's not on the board. Coming around one side of the pincer movement through Spain. And they were finally defeated in Germany after 1500. And so, you know, it was just been a total swamping of much of the Holy Land, the Arabic nations, and a whole bunch of stuff that Islam is the answer of God for an idolatrous Christianity. And I'll read you some more about that in a little bit. Let's make sure we're all on the same page with this. It's church history, but this goes back, we're now living this in our country. So let's make sure we know what we're talking about. First of all, look in Joshua chapter 23. I tell you what, let's go to Genesis 25 first. Genesis 25, make sure you know where this all came from. And it goes to show that, you know, we know that Adam made a mistake and we're all paying for it. Well, Abraham made a mistake too. And it's amazing that a mistake like that can redound and echo down through thousands and thousands of years. So Genesis 25, go on down to verse 13, 25:13. You'll notice in verse 1 that Abraham takes a wife. Her name's Keturah. But down in 25:13, we're talking about Ishmael here. Now, Ishmael is the father of the Arabic nations. And so in verse 13, these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names, according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael was Nebajah and Kedar and Abiel and Mibsham. And as you can track some of that stuff through. But that's basically the root of the Arabic nations. Keturah was another wife. Of course, he was through Hagar, Ishmael. But Keturah had some other kids, and some of those even blended into the Arabic issue. But the main thing about Ishmael was, you'll find in Genesis chapter 16, verse 12, that Ishmael from the start was going to be trouble. 16:12. Start with verse 11. The angel of the Lord said unto her, "Behold, thou art with child, shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, and because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Okay, that is Ishmael. That is the Arab. And like I said, Abraham made a mistake of listening to his wife in going into Hagar, and we're still seeing the reverb on that, right? And so that's where all this started. That's where it all came from. He's going to be a wild man. And so, you know, while, you know, Iran is Persia, that's not the same lineage. They're still have an Arabic religion. And so you see, you know, you've heard the negotiations of the Strait of Hormuz and all that. They can't be depended upon. They're wild. Usually their word is not good. And I'm just saying. But Islam is one of the most enduring indictments against Christianity to ever rise. The apostasy of the church was the cause and the open door for Muhammad. And I want to say that that's not just a Ruckmanite opinion, just for what it's worth. I'm going to read to you just a little bit here off and on tonight. And then I think at the end there will be a little bit of a surprise, I think. One history writer says we can regard Muhammadism in no other light than as a scourge of God upon a guilty church. He will not give his glory to another. He will not suffer the creator and the creature to be confounded. If those who should have been witnesses for the truth, who had been appointed thereunto, forsake, forget, or deny it, he will raise up witnesses from quarters the most unlooked for, and will strengthen their hands and give victory to their arms. He's talking there about Islam. The Mohammedan, there's another writer, the Mohammedan religion arose in the providence of God as a scourge to the idolatrous Christianity and the pagan system of Asia and Africa, a protest against polytheism and a preparation for the future conversion to a pure Christianity of a multitude, we hope. I wanted to say here another... There it is. Carlyle calls the creed of Muhammad a kind of Christianity better than that of those miserable Syrian sects. Now, I think he's wrong about that, but here's what he said further. It's a bastard kind of Christianity. A bastard kind of Christianity. The whole thing is that Islam is pretty much a scourge due to idolatry. We're talking here about the Catholic Church primarily, and of course the Eastern Orthodox churches. But Islam, Muhammad lived from 570, we think. At the end of this, I've got some curveballs to throw you because I just finished a book that it cast some light on this some of this may not be true. That I'm going to tell you tonight. But Muhammad supposedly lived from 570 to 632. Islam means resignation to God. The word Muslim means one who resigns himself to God. And the Arabians are primarily tribal. They're disorganized religiously and politically. Again, they tend to be more like the American Indians as far as the tribalism is concerned. But during the Roman persecutions, many Christians and Jews fled there for safety. And so they had exposure to both Jewish things and Christian things. Now that's going to, again, when I get to the end of this, they may want to remember that because that's going to come into play here. But so there's Jewish things contained in the Islamic mindset, the religion. Abraham, Seth, Ishmael, Hagar, Christian things, Christ, prophecy, various other things, as well as the heathen things. The result is an admixture of political, military, religious, holy causes. And in the end, even though he was inconsistent with it, Muhammad thought it was perfectly right and good to kill your enemies that don't agree with you. Islam is filled with ridiculous things. We'll say more about that in a second too, I think. But the Al-Kaaba is a small oblong temple in Mecca. That's the place of Muhammad's birth. It is now enclosed in this big mosque. It was, just so you know, built by angels. Angels literally came down and built it. And Adam worshiped there after his expulsion from the garden, too. It was a long walk, but that's where he worshiped there. Seth rebuilt it of clay, whatever that means. Then after the flood, Ishmael and Abraham rebuilt it. So that's the true history of Al-Kaaba. Now you know the rest of the story. Anyway, the Black Stone is in the northeast corner of the Al-Kaaba by the door. Incidentally, this rock, it fell from paradise with Adam, turned from milk white to black due to men's sins. It's about 6 inches by 8 inches. It's covered with silk and tapestry, and it's kissed by all the pilgrims that come there. And just remember when they're kissing it that Islam is supposed to be against idolatry. The well Zemzem is where Ishmael and Hagar got their drink when Ishmael was thirsty. The Quran, 114 surahs or topics. There's over 6,000 verses in it, and supposedly divinely inspired by the angel Gabriel. We'll have more discussion on that here in just a little bit. But here are some things that who here has ever read the Quran? If not all the way through, partway through. Good reading, right? Okay. These guys don't think so. These are, again, guys that have studied it, but let me see if I can find the right place. Now, supposedly Muhammad prepared and dictated the Quran from time to time as he received the revelations and progressed in his career. Now, none of it is contextual. It is all just intermingled, you know, flip-flop stuff, off the top of his head, stream of consciousness type stuff, scattered all over the place. The Quran was collected together by several people a couple of hundred years after Muhammad died. And so as far as it being a Bible like what we have, as far as the final word, you'll see in a little while, that's not true at all. But these are just discombobulated writings. It's like reading stuff, that stream of consciousness with somebody's mind who's going all over the place. It's like a schizophrenic poetry Bible. And the Quran was from time to time received by him. And of course, he goes through and is dictating. This is not for readers, but for hearers, leaving much to the suggestive action of the public recital, either from memory or from copies taken down by his friends. You know, people talk about the original manuscripts of the Bible. Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff that nobody has but by word of mouth with the Quran. And that's part of the problem. But hence its occasional fragmentary character. About a year after his death, at the direction of his father-in-law and immediate successor, Zayed, collected the scattered fragments of the Quran, and there are many, many different versions of what was pulled together. We'll say more about that a little bit later. But I wanted to read you what people say about it. It has many passages of poetic beauty, religious fervor, and wise counsel, but mixed with absurdities, bombast, unmeaning images, low sensuality. It abounds in repetitions and contradictions, which are not removed by various convenient theories. It alternately attracts and repels. It is a most wearisome book to read. Amen. Gibbon, a great historian, calls the Quran a glorious testimony to the unity of God, but also very properly an endless, incoherent rhapsody of fable and precept and declamation, which seldom excites a sentiment or idea, which sometimes crawls in the dust and is sometimes lost in the clouds. So it's all over the place. It's a terrible book. Risky denounces it as a most absurd book and a scourge for a reader of sound common sense. So I'm just telling you, it's bad Arabic poetry. Carlyle calls the Quran the confused ferment of a great rude human soul. Rude, untutored, that cannot even read, and apparently Muhammad could not read. But fervent, earnest, struggling vehemently to utter itself in words. Carlyle also confesses that the reading of the Koran in English is a toilsome task, and a wearisome, confused jumble, crude, incudite, endless iterations, long-windedness, entanglement, insupportable stupidity. In short, nothing but a sense of duty could carry any European through the Koran. So he's not a fan. Anyway, but yeah, the Koran. So Muhammad is born in 570, supposedly. You're going to find out that that's a little bit iffy. And in fact, we're going to find out later that his existence may be even in question. But I'll save that for later. So here's how he's born. Anybody want to know? Of course you do. Tradition surrounds his advent in the world with a halo of marvelous legends. He was born circumcised with his navel cut, with the seal of prophecy written on his back, in letters of light, by the way. As a newborn babe, he prostrated himself at once on the ground and, raising his hands, prayed for the pardon of his people. Three persons, brilliant as the sun, one holding a silver goblet, the second an emerald tray, a third a silken towel, appeared from heaven, washed him seven times, then blessed and saluted him as the prince of mankind. He was nursed by a healthy Bedouin woman. Okay. Thanks for adding that in. When a boy of 4 years, he was seized with something like a fit of epilepsy, which historians transformed into a miraculous occurrence. He was often subject to severe headaches, feverish convulsions in which he fell on the ground like a drunken man and snored like a camel. In his 6th year, he lost his mother on the return from Medina, whether he had she'd taken him on a camel's back to visit maternal relations. And so he was carried back to Mecca by his nurse, a faithful slave girl. As he grew up, let me find my place here where I left off. He married at 25. He married Khadijah, who was a rich widow. She was 15 years older than him. Who had previously hired him to carry on the mercantile business of her former husband. Her father was opposed to the marriage, but she made and kept him drunk until the ceremony was completed. He took charge of her caravans with great success and made several journeys. Their marriage was happy and fruitful of 6 children, 2 sons, and 4 daughters. All died except for little Fatima, who became the mother of innumerable legitimate and illegitimate descendants of the prophet. Oh boy, yeah. Yeah. He also adopted Ali, whose close connection with him became so important to the history of Islam. He was faithful to Khadijah and held her in grateful remembrance after her death. He used to say, "Khadijah believed in me when nobody else did." He married afterwards a number of wives who caused him much trouble and scandal. His favorite wife, Aisha, was more jealous of the dead Khadijah than any of her other 12 more living rivals. He constantly held up Khadijah as the he constantly held up the toothless old woman as a model of a wife. So anyway, let me move on here first. So here's what he's like, just about his nature. He had a melancholic and nervous temperament, liable to fantastic hallucinations, alternations of high excitement and deep depression, bordering at times on despair and suicide. The story of his early and frequent epileptic fits throws some light on his revelations, during which he sometimes growled like a camel, foamed at the mouth, and streamed with perspiration. He believed in evil spirits, omens, charms, and dreams. His mind was neither clear nor sharp, but it was strong and fervent, and under the influence of exuberant imagination. He was a poet of high order, and the Quran is the first classic in Arabic literature. He lived with his wives in a row of low and homely cottages of unbaked bricks, aided with them with their household duties. He was strictly temperate in eating and drinking, his chief diet being dates and water. He was not ashamed to milk the goats, to mend his clothes and cobble his shoes. And this was supposed to be a woman's work, so they made fun of him for that some. His personal property, his death, amounted to some confiscated lands, 14 or 15 slaves, a few camels and mules, 100 sheep, and a rooster. Don't forget the rooster. He was modest and bashful with visitors that came, but towards his enemies, he was cruel and vengeful, did not shrink from perfidy, which is treachery, faithlessness. He believed in the use of the sword as the best missionary and was utterly unscrupulous as to the means of success. He had great moral courage, but very little physical courage. He was a slave of sensual passion. Aisha, who knew him best, by the way, that's his daughter that he married at 8 years old. She brought her dollies to the wedding. True. Anyway, Aisha, who knew him best in his private character and habits, used to say, "The Prophet loved three things: women, perfume, and food. He had his heart's desire of the first two and not of the last." The motives of his excess in polygamy were his sensuality, which grew with his years, his desire for male offspring. His followers excused him because the mantle of a prophet deserves other comforts in life. So that's why he got more wives than anybody else, because of he was a prophet. It's the bottom line. It's not how it says it here, but he had at least 14 legal wives, a number of slave concubines besides. At his death, he left 9 widows. He claimed special revelations which gave him greater liberty to have more wives than usual. Sounds like an excuse to me. Aisha, the daughter, was his special favorite. He married her when she was a girl of 9 years. He was 53. She brought her doll babies with her and amused and charmed the prophet by her playfulness, vivacity, and wit. She could read, had a copy of the Quran, knew more about theology, genealogy, and poetry than all the other widows of Muhammad. He announced that she would be his wife in paradise, yet she was not free from suspicion of unfaithfulness until he received a revelation about her innocence. So, as a little kid, he suspected her of not being faithful until he got a revelation from God that said she had been. So that was good. I'm sorry, I'm just being a little bit sarcastic. So he makes a few converts. He gets the call of Gabriel at Mount Hira in 610. Let me just see if I can find that real quick. In his 40th year, he received the call of Gabriel, the archangel at the right hand of God, who announced the birth of the Savior to the Virgin Mary. The first revelation was made to him in a trance in the wild solitude of Mount Hira, an hour's walk from Mecca. He was directed to cry in the name of the Lord. He trembled as if something dreadful had happened to him, hastened home to his wife, who told him to rejoice, for he would be the prophet of his people. He waited for other visions, but none came. He went up to Mount Hira again, this time to commit suicide. But as often as he approached the precipice, he beheld Gabriel at the end of the horizon, saying to him, "I am Gabriel, and thou art Muhammad, the prophet of God. Fear not." So he started receiving revelations from Gabriel. The revelations continued from time to time for more than 20 years. When asked how they delivered it, they were delivered to him, he replied that sometimes they sound like the sound of a bell, a kind of communication which was very severe for me. And when the sound ceased, I found myself aware of the instruction. And sometimes the angel would come in the form of men and converse with me, and all his words I remembered. For after the next several years after his call, he labored among his people and just had a few converts, including Khadijah, who was his first convert, his old wife, and some of his family around him. He had to flee to Mecca, from Mecca to Medina in 622. That was a 250-mile journey that is now called the Hegira, H-E-G-I-R-A. And he got there, and one of the things that he taught was that people should not be compelled to religion. But that changed soon enough. But just so you know, he contradicted himself, saying that religion shouldn't be something that you were compelled to. But when he got power and had the sword, then he would compel them to do so. In 624, he went to war with 305 soldiers against another Arab tribe twice as large and defeated them. In 627, he personally watched the massacre of 600 Jews. In 630, he went back to Mecca, demolished the idols, and became the master of Arabia. And so from that point on, his last words were, "The Lord destroy the Jews and the Christians. Let his anger be kindled against those that turn the tombs of their prophets into places of worship." So that's how it kind of ended for him. He died of a fever in the arms of Aisha. He was 63. After his death, and you'll see where this plays in here in just a minute. Later tradition, and even his earliest biography, ascribed to the prophet of Mecca strange miracles and surround his name with a mythical halo of glory. He was saluted by walking trees and stones. He often made by a simple touch the udders of dry goats distend with milk. That's impressive. He caused floods of water to well up from the parched ground or gush forth from empty vessels, or issue from betwixt the fingers that when he raised his hand. He raised the dead. He made a night journey on his steed, Borak, through the air, from Mecca to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to paradise, and from there to the mansions of the prophets and angels, and back again to Mecca. But all of these things came, of course, after he died. They embellished it quite a bit. And from there, we'll talk more about that in just a second. So again, you see how things went for him. Now, this is history. That those first three or four entries there, what we know now is that the Arabs defeated those countries. Whether it was Islam as we know it now or not, I'll tell you more about it in a second. But the rough progression into North Africa in 690, crosses over into Spain in 711. He's finally defeated at Tours, France in 732. So that side, that western wing of the pincer movement was stopped there. Meanwhile, he's taking Baghdad, India. The Turks fall to him. The Mongols fall to him. And he's outside the gates of Constantinople in 1453. Everybody knows that part of history of the Muslims. But the real kicker is that we now don't know how much of that is true. And the reason why is because I got a book here. It's called Did Muhammad Exist? And the answer is probably, but not the way we're told. And so let me... I had a chance to finish it here today. I was working through it, trying to get through it so I could present all this. But bottom line is that the Koran, as if you've ever read it, it's unreadable and inscrutable and hard to understand. In fact, there's some stuff that is just simply not understood. There's stuff in it that Muslims don't understand. And the reason that's the case is it was put together by a madman who spouted his mouth off, and some people recorded some stuff, and then when Zayd started gathering it, he goes, and some of it is written on leaves, and some of it's written on parchment. Some of it is just gathered as a, you know, fireside tale from somebody who supposedly saw it. So as far as who knows, you know, how much of it was even legitimate, nobody knows. What you need to understand is that, you know, we think of the Koran as the Muslim Bible. If that's the Muslim Bible, it's still, there's almost no doctrine in it at all, and it's contradictory. And so what happened was, where the Muslims really go for their doctrine, their law, are the hadiths. Those are like commentaries, and that pen doesn't work very well, does it? The hadiths. There are hundreds of thousands of hadiths. What they are is traditions, deeds, stories told about what Muhammad thought or said that he believed from the Koran, what he really meant. The hadiths are dependent upon to grant context to some things in the Koran. In other words, well, what did Muhammad mean by this? Well, this guy was there when he said this, and this was the context in which he said it, and all that kind of thing. So the hadiths are just these things that come in from outside. These are all after Muhammad's death, but they are the foundation of Muslim law. There were no biographical details known of Muhammad's life until in the same century that Muhammad lived. Nobody can confirm. There's no written records of where he was, who he was. Everything that we know, everything that I went through, is basically known because of the hadiths. Okay? Nothing, interestingly enough, when the Muslims defeated Syria, when they went into Jerusalem, when they went into Egypt and Persia, nobody mentioned the word Islam. Nobody mentioned the word Muhammad. In fact, it's interesting that the reason the question is whether this all existed as history supposedly brings it to us. He's not denying that Muhammad might have existed. It's just that he believes that Muhammad did not exist in any way, though he's presented to us. And as far as there being an established Islamic religion like we know it today, in the mid-600s and into the 700s, it was not so. For instance, when the Arabs defeated the Byzantines and the Syrians in Jerusalem and at Jerusalem, of course, when a new monarchy takes over, then they change the coinage, the money, because you don't want, we have In God We Trust on our money. And if I'm not a Christian, then I don't want that on my money. So, interestingly enough, when they changed the coinage over and started making coins, Arabic coins, to trade with, they had symbols of the cross on the coins. There was no mention of Muhammad. There was no Islamic sayings or any of the phrasing that you find among the Islamists today on any of the coinage. And there's nothing about Allah. There's nothing about the Prophet. There is no evidence of Islam as reported. And it doesn't seem to have existed the way they tell us it existed when they're telling us it did. Nobody's denying that it has become that now, but they're saying it was constructed out of whole cloth. It was fabricated. And that much of Muhammad's life, the same thing is true. Muhammad seems to have been Muhammad seems to have been pro-Israel, letting Israel have their land early on in his life, strangely enough. The book is by Robert Spencer. It's called Did Muhammad Exist? It's a pretty enlightening read, as you can see since I'm teaching it tonight. But in the 660s, the Jews and the Muslims, according to Arabic writings of the time, were spiritual kin and political allies. In other words, you know, Allah was supposed to have immediately denounced the Jews and the Christians and sought to kill them, et cetera, and run them out of Jerusalem. But he was saying that the Holy Land did belong to the Jews, and they weren't his enemies at the time. He was okay for a while with the Islamists praying towards Jerusalem, not Mecca. There is nothing of the Quran mentioned through the 600s and the seven part of the 700s. Nothing of the Quran is mentioned. He iterates over and over again, no Muhammad, no Islam, no Quran is mentioned in the 600s and 700s when they were defeating these nations. This was simply an Arabic nation going in fighting and defeating the Byzantines and the Syrians, and they seem not to have even known anything about this prophet of Allah, Muhammad, and they don't seem to have had any kind of formulation of anything like Islam. What he hells forth happened is, since there are hundreds of thousands of hadiths, and because there were various Arabic factions, that all that happened was that each faction just created its own stories of Islam to bolster their position, their power. And so that's when it started reminding me of Catholicism, where you're making stuff up out of whole cloth. And, you know, after Muhammad's death, 200 years after his death, they're still making up stories about him and going to people whose grandfathers knew him or whatever. And their grandfather would miraculously be remembered that his grandfather miraculously told him something that Muhammad had said about something or other, and Allah had brought it to his mind. And so he would tell this story so that it would bolster this faction's position. So this happened over and over again. So that's why the stories are so monstrously crazy about how wacky Muhammad was. But they made up stories. All those stories are found in the hadiths. Lays out a steady stream of made-up stories, dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And again, there are hundreds of thousands of hadiths. So if that's the case, then if it's like Catholicism where you're just making up stories to bolster your position, then none of it's even true. So what I'm saying is the Muhammad that's presented to us wasn't even a historical fact. He was a made-up legendary character after he died. And Islam, as the historians present it now, like what we've talked about here, it wasn't even in action. It wasn't even in function. It didn't acknowledge Allah. It didn't acknowledge the Prophet or anything else until much later, until afterwards. I wanted to mention that the hadiths being many forgeries are admitted by both Muslims and non-Muslim scholars. So both sides find that many of the hadiths are complete forgeries made up out of whole cloth. By the way, he goes into quite a bit of linguistic stuff here, but much of the Quran is non-Arabic in origin. So it wasn't originally an Arabic book, which is to them a big deal. They always talk about it being the Arabic book in the Arabic language, okay? But a lot of it was not Arabic in origin. For instance, the Arabic language is a lot like Hebrew, where some of the letters depend upon the diacritical markings, the dots and dashes underneath or above, so you know what the word means. Well, that was equally true with the Arabic. And some of the scholars, even Muslim scholars, say that one sentence out of every five in the Quran is not completely obscure and not understandable. And so what they started doing is thinking about, for instance, just taking out the diacritical markings. There were no diacritical markings in Muhammad's day. And so they took out the diacritical markings and started considering what other things it might have said without the markings in there. I mean, you have the same letters, but you just don't have the dots and dashes that give you vowels. And it changes the meanings of words. So the bottom line is, for instance, the promise about 72 virgins in paradise, it turns out to be 72 raisins. You need to think about that. But like I said, the guy says that every fifth sentence makes no sense whatsoever. And so everything points to the idea that this was all forged and that everything was a made-up story after a certain point because many of the Arabic factions wanted to get, you know, wanted to take and fabricate Muhammad to be like them and to agree with them. And so, again, that's an awful lot of Catholicism. There's also, he goes into it at quite a bit of length. I read it today, so I didn't absorb all of it yet. But he was saying that there's a undertone in the Quran about, you know, the issue. There's some things that when you study it linguistically, which of course I don't, but that they acknowledge Christ quite a bit. By the way, Muhammad shows up in the Quran 4 times. Christ shows up many other times. But that what they think happened, actually, he said, where did the Quran come from? Well, apparently the Quran came from, since they pretty much prove that it's not Arabic in origin, that a lot of it came from Hebrew writing, Hebrew scripture, and, you know, Christian scripture that was kind of hijacked. And apparently, one thing that seeped in was, remember Arianism, where Arius believed that Christ was a created God. Well, a bunch of people that believe that, once they were outed at the Council of Nicaea, fled into Arabic lands to reside, you know, to escape persecution. And so what they think happened is that a lot of this anti-idolatry stuff and all that in the Quran had to do with the fact that a backslidden heretical Christianity made its way down to them. They adopted that into all of their hijacked Hebrew and their hijacked Greek New Testament stuff. And out of that, they created this whole cloth of Islamic nonsense. And so it's full of contradictions. It doesn't make any sense. And so this guy says that neither Islam nor Muhammad existed the way it's presented that they existed at the times they were there. That all of that stuff was actually made up afterwards. And that, of course, now Islam is what it is and became what it is. But as far as back in the 600s and 700s, it wasn't like that at all. That in that day, when the Arabs would come in and conquer, say, Byzantine or the Syrian Empire, of course, they would start making their own coins and melting down the old coins. They wound up with crosses, which is supposed to be hated by Muslims. They would have crosses on their coinage and other Christian symbols on their coinage, which if Muhammad was the head of all that and totally against it, they would not have. So the bottom line is, a lot of what we quote-unquote know about Muhammad and Islam in its early history may not even be true. The book is called Did Muhammad Exist? By Robert Spencer. And I was on a 2-day vacation with my wife, so that's all I got for you tonight. We were tearing up the town in Duluth. So, any questions or comments? Brother, yes, sir.